This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. For much of the last 2,000 years, the Great Wall has been the symbol of China, built to keep all the nomadic tribes from the heart of the Middle Kingdom. With China's modern borders set firm, there's probably less threat to the rulers in Beijing from outside than from inside their country. Many of the Muslim peoples of northwest China feel little allegiance to Beijing. NPR's Rob Gifford has been traveling across China from east to west, taking one road, Route 312. Today, he travels among the Uyghur people of northwest China and reaches the end of his 3,000-mile journey.
All along this part of Route 312 are reminders of history, but none more striking than this one where I'm standing now, the fortress at Jiayuguan. This is the westernmost point of the Great Wall of China, some 1,300 miles west of Beijing. Now fully renovated, it's an impressive rectangular fort, and I'm looking out from the top of it at miles and miles of desert beyond. Historically, the Chinese often controlled territory west of here, but for centuries this was really the last major stronghold of the Emperor against the nomadic Muslim tribes in the west. And still today, the largely Muslim minority peoples west of here continue to give problems to Beijing. It's a long drive west from Jiayuguan across the Gobi Desert into the northwestern province of Xinjiang, which in Chinese means new frontier. One of the first things you notice when Route 312 finally deposits you in the regional capital of Urumqi is the smell. For more than 2,000 miles, the smells have all been of China. In the bazaars of Urumqi, on the other hand, it smells like Central Asia, of spices and flatbread, and, if it has a smell, of Islam. The tectonic plates of Asia meet in Urumqi, where the nomads of Central Asia collide with the settled population of China. Chinese characters hold a linguistic monopoly on road signs in the eastern half of the country. In markets here, they have to jostle with the Arabic alphabet of the indigenous Uyghur language. The second thing that hits you about Urumqi is music. Four musicians sprawl lazily on a bench on a busy shopping street near the main bazaar. They make a noise that seems disproportionate to the energy they're expending. All wear colourful Islamic Uyghur caps. In front of them, a middle-aged Uyghur man dressed in a suit whirls like an office dervish on the sidewalk. Perhaps he's drunk. Perhaps he's on his lunch break. Perhaps he's just letting off steam. As you walk through the bazaar, you feel there are a lot of Uyghurs who need to let off some steam. The air is heavy, the faces are long, people glance continually over their shoulder. You imagine people here are not dreaming of Shanghai, they're dreaming of Tashkent and Almaty and Samarkand in Central Asia. Rows of women sit sewing bright-coloured traditional Uyghur costumes, a stark contrast to the greens and browns of the Chinese markets. The mix of mystical Sufi Islam and the fading influence of communism means you occasionally see a woman with her head covered but wearing a miniskirt. Few of the women speak Mandarin Chinese, even though it's supposed to be compulsory in the schools. In a whole day, walking around the bazaar in central Urumqi, not a single person would answer my questions about relations between the Han Chinese and the Uyghurs. Either they didn't speak Chinese or they simply didn't want to talk. The fear is deep here. Many Uyghurs feel their land has been occupied, and occasionally there's a riot or an attack on a Chinese police station. But the Uyghurs are badly armed and badly organized. They've no chance against the heavily armed Chinese police and military. And now, through Beijing's enforced migration policies, Han Chinese outnumber Uyghurs in Xinjiang. Beijing is now making a huge effort to integrate the Uyghurs into China. A new project has been launched called the Xibu Dakai Fa, or Great Development of the West. The aim is to raise the standard of living of the country's poorest citizens in the western regions and thus make the Muslim minorities less likely to revolt. The new wealth is certainly starting to show in Urumqi, though not necessarily in the Uyghur communities.
Well, would you believe it? You cross the Gobi Desert for hours and hours on a bus, and what do you find at the other end? A bowling alley. I bet Marco Polo never found one of these. There may be plenty of angry people here in Urumqi, especially among the ethnic minorities, but as with everywhere in China, the flip side is there are lots of happy people too, benefiting here from central government policies to develop the western regions. And there's plenty of Urumqi's new middle class here just having fun bowling at the weekend.
There's also some ethnic integration happening. Li Xiangrong is here bowling with her family. Her husband is not Han Chinese, but a member of the Hui Muslim minority group. Just a few years ago, she says, the two ethnic groups would rarely have mixed. Li works in a boom industry for a company supplying electricity in Urumqi, and she can't believe the changes going on here. I went away for 2 years, came back, and I didn't recognize it, she says. It's unbelievable. It's a great place to live now. Her 17-year-old son agrees. Urumqi was so boring just a few years ago, he says. Now suddenly all these great places have sprung up to come and have fun. Soon, it's time to leave Urumqi on the final stage of the journey along Route 312, a 15-hour overnight bus ride to the border of the former Soviet Republic of Kazakhstan. More kung fu movies on the bus, more endless desert. All those hundreds of millions of people crammed into half of China's landmass in the east, and this half almost empty. 100 miles from the border, the bus breaks down, and I have to hitch the last few hours with a trucker. The road right at the end leaves the desert and winds up into the hills. Not quite like viewing the Pacific Ocean from Route 66, but a pleasant final hour to the border and a break from the monotony of the desert. And then before you know it, you're at the border town of Korgaz, or Huaraguosi as it's known in Chinese. A market full of people selling souvenirs, Kazakh money changers hustling on the street. I've come 3,000 miles from Shanghai, the equivalent of traveling from New York City to Los Angeles. So this is it. This is where my journey ends. Over there in front of me is Kazakhstan. Behind me here is the last stretch of Route 312. And what a long, strange trip it's been. As I've traveled this road, I've seen close up the social and economic revolution that's turning China upside down. What's less clear, though, is where all the convulsive change is leading in the long run. The experiment with communism was supposed to bring equality to all the different kinds of people I've seen along this road. It was supposed to bring an end to the centuries-old cycle of dynastic rise and fall, national collapse and reunification. Now, with communism in retreat, I've seen with my own eyes the old inequalities are back. How the government deals with those and with the distribution of the new wealth across the breadth of this great country may well be what decides whether China goes forward to a different and better future, or if Chinese history is just destined to repeat itself all over again. This is Rob Gifford, NPR News, at the end of Route 312 on the China-Kazakhstan border.
Previous reports in Rob Gifford's series On the Road in China are at npr.org.